Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast, which is brought to you by the Mighty Kraken. I'm your host, Peter McCormack, and right now I'm at the airport. I'm about to fly to El Salvador. Having just flown in from Caracas, it's 3:30 a.m. I'm pretty tired, but I want to get the show out, the show with Javier Bastardo out for you. But just a few notes up front. It might be a bit noisy in the background. I'm in the airport. I'm recording this intro and outro on my iPhone. We couldn't take our equipment into Venezuela. As a Maduro regime doesn't like journalists, you know, we knew that if we were taking the equipment, we would have been interrogated. They've also got a habit of arresting journalists, and even recently they arrested and put in jail an influencer just for a tweet. So we only took our iPhones and our camera each and pretended we were just travel bloggers. And we did also actually get pulled over by the police and threatened with arrest if we were making any anti-government content. Our local fixer managed to get us out of that, which was a really weird situation, as you know, we were pulled over by, I think it was five police officers on the main highway. Anyway, as such, I had some pretty basic equipment to record this interview, so the sound isn't the best. And also, please bear with Javier. His English is pretty good, but he has a strong accent. But because I wanted someone on the scene there, I want to get the truth of what was happening. And having spoken to Javier over the last few months and knowing that he works for Cointelegraph as a journalist, he's pretty plugged into the scene. And I wanted him to clear up the myths around Bitcoin and any other nonsense with shitcoins like Dash. So sorry for the long intro, but I just wanted to set this up. I've got no idea how this will sound when it comes out. I should give a shout out to my sponsors before we get into the show. So firstly, the amazing BlockFi. You know I love these guys. They're the future of Bitcoin and financial services. Spent some time with Zach recently. They've just announced another huge round of investment because everything's pointing in the right direction. And they've got some cool shit coming. They've got their Bitcoin rewards card, which I can't wait for. I told Zach, I said, I want one of the first. I want sats back on my purchases with my credit card. But they've also got an app coming. So it's going to be a massive year for BlockFi. They do have their amazing products already. They've got their interest accounts and their crypto loans. So listen, if you want to check out BlockFi, head over to blockfi.com. It's BlockFi.com. And also a big shout out to the Mighty Kraken, the best place to buy, sell, and trade Bitcoin. It's the only place I use to buy and sell Bitcoin now. It's the most trusted exchange. They've got badass security. They've got every possible trading option you should want as well. Whether you want to trade futures or you're one of those crazy leverage traders, Jesse's always kicking ass with it. I love Kraken. If you want to trade Bitcoin and you want somewhere that you trust, head over to Kraken.com or download their new app, Kraken Pro. That is K-R-A-K-E-M-P-R-O, and that's available for the Android and iPhone. Okay, just a couple of notes before we start the show. I'm going to do my own show about my experience in Venezuela. I've asked my friend Stefan Lavera to interview me. Kind of going to be a weird one, but I wanted to share my experience, and I just thought it would help if someone grilled me. So I've asked Stefan. He said he would do it. And also, if you haven't seen or if you haven't heard, one of my sponsors, their CEO, Larry Harmon, has been arrested on money laundering charges related to the source of his funds. That's my sponsor, Dropbit. So right now I've pulled the ads. I am talking to Larry's brother. I am trying to find out what's happening with the app, and I am going to try and talk to Larry as well, even though he's in jail. It's a pretty desperate situation. But yeah, please bear with me. I will find out what's going on here. A lot of moving parts. Anyway, if you've got any feedback or questions, I'd love to hear from you. Please get in touch. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. Right. Javier, Adam, thank you for having me here. Thank you for inviting me to your office here in Venezuela. Had an amazing trip. I'm just did a show in Colombia and also one in Santiago. I want to do a series as I go around the world, just kind of finding out the realities of Bitcoin used in countries, because Venezuela is a really interesting topic because a lot of people talk about Venezuela has been an amazing use case for Bitcoin. It comes up again and again. The reality has been very different. But as a starting point, I always think it's good for these ones to get into a bit of history of politics and the economy, which is really relevant here in Venezuela, right?
Yeah. Well, thanks for coming to Venezuela, Peter. Well, the problem is really difficult to explain because it has its roots down in our history. So we can talk about how the oil have interfered with how our economy, how many other things has changed while we could be as a country, but in the most recent history, we can talk about Chavez and Maduro and the Chavismo. So
yeah, Chavez has a strong hold over this country, even though he's not alive anymore. You know, it was someone in the taxi that sent to me that Chavez managed to win an election after he died. You know, Maduro won because of Chavez. But can we just go back a step before Chavez? You know, and I'm not sure how old you are and where this fits in, but can you just explain what Venezuela was like before Chavez?
Well, I'm not that older to remember exactly how it was, but as I learned, the people struggling to get the food, this is not a new thing to us. So Venezuela is like a crisis after crisis after crisis country, but people was not this miserable like we are today, and the industry works better. So
it was the richest country in South America, though, right?
Yeah, but the same thing with the inequity was in that time. So one of the things that helped Chavez to get the power was this precisely, that there were many inequity, even when the country was rich, there were many people that don't have the money or can't afford things. So I think that even when we can think in Venezuela like a better place before all these things, it had its own problems, but back in the day.
Okay. And Chavez came into power, you know, populist rhetoric, populist policies, you know, he was going to help the poor, you know, Venezuela has a lot of oil, the oil price was high, so he implemented a lot of social programs, and, you know, he was a very popular president, right?
Yes, he had a great charisma, you know. It was crazy. People was crazy about him.
I remember seeing a news story, I think, where did he still live in his same house and drive his old Beetle?
Yeah, he did. A red Beetle.
Yeah. So, but how many terms did Chavez serve?
I think three terms.
Served three terms. And did you start to notice the country start to, I don't know how to put this, but the very difficult position the country was in 2016, which seems to have been the bottom, seems to be the worst time. When did this all start to unravel, though? Was it in the mid-2000s, 2010? When did it start to be kind of obvious that these social programs were unsustainable?
I think, and this is a joke that I used to make with some of my friends, like, when we lost Venezuela, like, when was that time? And maybe after 2009, 2010, after that point, we reached our top, obviously the oil prices decline have some influence in this, because the main policy of Chavez was to spend the dollars that the oil gave the country. But after 2010, things get weird, like people start to make lines to buy food. We used to eat too much arepa, and many people start to make lines to buy this arena farm, you know, to can make the arepas and many other things.
Was that like one of the first signs that things were getting bad?
Yeah, like just only the line in my, like see the people making the line was a big punch in your face about the reality, about how things are becoming weirder. And also after the Chavez died, after he was deceased, the things go also wilder, like the prices becoming rising, the dollar rising. So it's difficult to think like it like remember how it was before. I don't remember how much the dollar costs, how much the expensive of life. It's difficult to remember before we enter in this crisis.
And things under Maduro have got a lot worse.
Yeah, and as you said, Chavez won that election as he was the one that chose, like, vote for him. I'm pretty clear as the full moon, like, this is my
successor.
You have to choose him because this is the way that we can continue with the power and so on. And as we don't knew how Maduro was as a politician, because he was a councillor, he was not in the inner politics, so we don't know how it will work. So it only got get worse. So
okay, and how would you describe the differences between Chavez and Maduro?
At the first time, Maduro was a tiny leader. Like, he don't want to speak so louder. Many reference to "I'm the son of Chavez," "I'm the successor," and even the propaganda was with Chavez face, not with him. So in this first phase, he was like trying to be so friendly, trying to be kind, you know, trying to create this narrative of a good leader in a kind of way. And after he become more strong, after he can stabilize the power, he seems to forget this need to keep friendly, keep near to the people. So his leadership become a little stranger. He danced in the public TV. He try to assume that everything is okay, and there are other leaders around him that talks about what is next on the government. Like, it's a kind of, no matter what I do, I will hold the power, kind of.
Okay. Try and explain to people listening how bad things got in 2016, 2017. The whole time I've been here, people keep referring to those years, and you know, and it was very desperate, but they also say things have got better since then. I keep hearing this. So how bad did things get?
We, in that time, we get riots in the streets. Many people died, because one of the worst things on the normalization of Venezuela is that people still die. People died for starving, people died because they don't have medicine. But in that time, people was killed by the public forces, and this is a human rights violation, but nothing changed since then. but we like the regime have a full control. People stop to protest because in 2017 there was a law that criminalized the protest, and there's also a law on hate crimes. Like, if you go to the streets and make a protest, probably will face or terrorism or one of those two new laws. So to protest is really it's really difficult. So maybe that's why the regime have a stronger control here. And that in 2016, there was many people protesting, many people trying to make a change, a political change, but the opposition leaders letting alone, like they cleaner their hands and you do your riot, you do your shit there, but they don't face in the political game against Maduro to help those people that was protesting to achieve something relevant. So at the end of the day, people just died, and we continue with this nightmare that only gets worse.
What was it like surviving during those periods? You know, what were some of the most difficult challenges you faced with regards to your income, with regards to buying necessities such as food, toiletries, medicine? Talk me through what it was like during that period.
In that moment, I was living in another place in the cities, but in that place, there like closed the urbanization, and was difficult to buy things, but the people around the main supermarket there organized to buy it directly to the people of the market and things like that. And to be honest, in that place, the riots weren't so hard. So in my personal experience, the more near the space where I was, there wasn't so danger, but there was zones like Bellomonte, like Altamira, like Los Dos Caminos, many places where the things really get wider. In Bellomonte, many people had the control of the streets. They closed the streets so the old people can buy food.
So it's quite a desperate time.
Yeah, and even if you don't get affected directly, that is my case, that you can move outside your place because you will be in danger, or that you know that you can go to the university because it's closed, and these things make difficult to have a normal life.
Like, or if you get sick, going to the hospital.
Yeah. And in that moment was a problem with some people that think that they are making a good choice and closing the streets and that. And those other people that want to go to the hospital, want to go to her jobs, I don't know, but like they have a different point of view on how we can stand against the regime, how we can fight them.
Yeah, so a few interesting experiences for me. Firstly, we just stumbled across a Maduro rally, a pro-Maduro rally, and It was a lot of people. I would say over 100,000 people, probably. Definitely tens of thousands. Like this endless line of people cheering, celebrating. They're all in red. They're carrying Chavez, you know, pictures, Maduro pictures. They're playing Maduro songs. They looked happy. I was surprised to see this because I was under the impression that Venezuela was in such a desperate state that no one would like Maduro. And also, online, people were sharing this, saying, here's proof that people do like Maduro. What does that make you think when I explain that?
Look, I don't really know if people really like Maduro, you know? I think it's the government pay those people with food, with like bonuses, so they can go to the valley and also a day off.
Right. Are they pressured to go to these?
I don't know. I think so.
Yeah.
I think so, yes.
I do find it hard to believe that everyone is doing it out of force, though. I'm sure there is a leg, like the Chavistas, right? You know, they are people who are passionate, you know, almost like they see Chavez as a saint, as a hero. And therefore, if Maduro was required to carry on his legacy, if you don't have Maduro, say if you had Guaido, you know, he would undo the great work of Chavez. So I find it hard to believe that there are no people who support Maduro.
I think there's a little bit of people that support Maduro.
Okay.
People that are like into files. Of course, they support Maduro, but they make him a lot of money.
Yep.
But I don't think the people support Maduro.
Yeah. What about Guaido? Yeah, about a year ago, he made some pretty bold promises. And one of the things I've noticed, so I went to his Congress, and there weren't a lot of people there. You know, it was quite quiet. As compared to the Maduro rally. And I've also asked a few people now, you know, who do they prefer, Maduro or Guaido? And actually, quite a few people have said they don't like either of them. They really don't like Maduro. But they don't think Guaido is the person to fix this. And a common point people make is that this isn't down to one person. One man can't fix this. What are your just... You know, and I'll ask the question to both of you. How do you think this is fixed? And what would you like to see happen?
Well, I don't know if we can have a fix in the short term. I don't see it. I think like the regime have a strong control over the interpolitics, so it's difficult to say that even if many nations around the world are cheering Guaido, he can't make anything here. And I don't know if he has a clear internal agenda, because as we saw, he was parroting some lemma, some ideas about how we can make this change, but nothing of that comes into the reality. But of course, like, it is necessary to have some institutions, some critic masses to have at least to make us a point, make the voice of the people that don't agree with Maduro to be listened, but I want to see a change. Of course, I want to see these people out of the power, but I don't think like we can make it only with external support. We need I don't know how to build a movement. I don't really know, because as the time has passed, many people just seems to be a collaborationist, a politic that are helping the regime to continue the power. So who we will trust to make the work? If there you can't expect that one man can make the whole change, but if you can stand with one of those men that have values, that you say, well, he don't want to spend his whole life in the power, but we don't have those kind of politics. Maybe that's why Guaido has that strange entrance on the political scene, because we don't knew him before he get in the interim president. But after 1 year, he still like with a kind of legitimacy inside the country. So maybe he can begin to build something inside the country. I don't know.
Okay. I also saw a lot of people online making statements such as, oh, well, Maduro got 68% of the vote. He is the legitimate president. And, you know, Guaido is nothing more than the attempt by America for a coup. And the only reason the Venezuelan economy is suffering is because of American sanctions. Now, I personally find those statements kind of ignorant, especially having come here, especially having witnessed the propaganda that sits internally, the difference between the east and west of the city. But if someone was to say that to you, what response do you have for them? Because you, I mean, I'm, it's a loaded question because we've already discussed this. But what do you say to people?
So the main problem with the election is that we don't understand like any percent like the regime can have in any election is a relevant number, because many of the people that can vote don't vote, simply didn't go to the election.
Why not?
Because the authority of the CNE, the main authority of the elections here, they're obviously with Maduro. So how you will play with an arbitrary that is with the other team?
You can't trust it. Yeah.
So okay. Red cards over all candidates. So many of the leaders of the opposition are over the play of the elections. And so the main problem is when people talks about the elections here, ignores that all the authorities are controlled by the regime. So there is no democracy, there is no a democratic election, like all the people that want to participate as candidates can't make it. So we have now a co-opted opposition, like a theater opposition, like is participating in convos with Maduro, and those are not the people we trust. We don't trust in anybody, but the new opposition, these new kind of leaders that are working to make a new thing and are not in need to have another authorities, are trying to only have new elections, are in this same kind of misinformation. So we have an Asamblea Nacional Constituyente that is a extra supra-constitutional authority that was elected to make a new constitution, but it has I think like 2 years or kind of 3 years, I don't know, I can't remember. And they're not writing a new constitution, they are simply making us acting Asamblea Nacional as an acting Asamblea Nacional, see, as an acting legislative. So
okay, legislative, yeah.
We don't have institutions.
Okay.
The institutions that legitimate those numbers in the election are the same that say that we don't have starving, that we don't have blackouts.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it's like the state propaganda, you know. And I believe it, it was Chavez who first started to break down the institutions and take control of the press. I believe that started before Maduro, right?
Yeah. We have a TV channel. Nobody sees national TV because all the channels are, if not directly related to propaganda, are transmitting some things like you don't need to see, and there's no news, or really tiny news time in the national TV, so nobody see that. But back in the day, we have RCTV that was a big oppositional channel, and it was shut down, so only gets worse and worse. Radio, TV, newspapers, the press don't have paper to print, so they migrate to the internet, but they get blocked. So we don't have any kind of big free press that can stand against the national propaganda. We have like a disarticulated movement of politicians, of people that are trying to build a narrative around those.
Mm-hmm.
Or that are trying to build a narrative around the journalism about investigation. And if you can find a way to show some truth over something, you will be get blocked, you will be get locked, and you will be jailed.
Well, yeah, I mean, I read about one journalist who was murdered, another influencer who was arrested and put in jail for tweeting, is I believe, yeah.
What
he a guy? One of there's an influencer here. We spoke about him yesterday. Who was arrested? Did he go to jail for tweeting?
Yeah. He was covering over things like you don't have to talk, and people just keeping.
All right. Well, listen, that's a very useful background. We should also talk about Bitcoin and cryptocurrency because, you know, that's the reason I've ended up here. You know, I've always wanted to visit Venezuela, but, you know, being in the world of Bitcoin, people are always talking about where the use cases are. And Venezuela has become one of the ones, the countries which people point to a lot and say, this is a great use for cryptocurrencies, it's a great use for Bitcoin, and, you know, and, you know, there's a lot of usage of it here. Before I came, you messaged me and said, the reality is very different. It's a lot smaller here than people think. So tell me about, firstly, give me a picture of who is using cryptocurrencies here, which cryptocurrencies they're using and for what purpose, and what the kind of size of the community is here.
Well, we are a tiny community, but we have seen that there are news about how we have new ATMs, how we have new payment processors. So we have many news over some things that are happening here. So there's things happening.
Yes.
But not in that big scale that people used to understand. So we have people that is cheering Dash. We have communities that work with Dash, and Dash has some experience in many places, not only in Caracas, but in other states outside here. And the main case of use and the most remarkable is the local Bitcoin's transaction volume. Maybe that's why people assume that we are using a lot of Bitcoin for remittance, for store of value, etc. But it's difficult to know how those people that are transacting over local Bitcoin are really using those Bitcoin that we have transacted. And as I work as a journalist, I know many of the people that are making something here. So you have little altcoins like Arepa coin. You have people that are working on wallets or Locha, Bitcoin Venezuela. There are many projects, but like a mass adoption, like a thing like you can go to the street and see people, oh, show me your QR, yeah, go have your sats. No, there's no happening, of course. And also we have our own difficulties with the power supply, with internet connection. So we, even if we have more, a bigger community, we have some issues that will make difficult to use Bitcoin or any other shitcoin. But I think that as we have an hyperinflation and we are trying to avoid use bolivars, but we are facing the dollar's problem, so we can simply use a bank account from America, or we can use PayPal because the fees are really expensive, etc. Maybe that's why people use it to think that we are using a lot of crypto, because we are looking in, or we are taking a place, or are looking the fight of many currencies. We have pesos, we have reais, que is the money of Brazil. We have many monies fighting, and Bitcoin is one of them. There are other cheat coins, but cryptocurrencies are a niche phenomenon. I think that this is kind of problematic to say, because many people is making business over this narrative. So sorry, I don't want you to lose your money, but the reality is we don't have a really big movement of people that know how to use and how to spend.
Next up, I talked to Javier more about the reality of Bitcoin in Venezuela. But before that, let me give a shout out to my amazing sponsors, because without them, I wouldn't be able to get to places like Venezuela. So firstly, CipherSafe, new to the podcast. If you want a very cool way to back up your private keys, then their newly released Cipher Wheel is fucking badass. So go and check it out. It's a unique way to store your private keys, machined from solid stainless steel. But not any stainless steel. 303 stainless steel. To be honest, I don't know what the fuck that is, but following Jameson Lott's test, this is the steel they needed so they could pass. This is easily one of the coolest Bitcoin seized devices I've ever seen. The Cipher Wheel is designed to be physically locked with a padlock and comes with a tamper evidence seal, so you can be aware if anyone is trying to steal your seed words. So you've got a hardware wallet, right? If you want to take your Bitcoin security seriously, go the extra step, get yourself a Cipher Wheel and protect yourself from physical disaster. If you want to find out more, head over to CipherSafe.io, which is CypherSafe.io, and purchase your Cipher Wheel and keep your Bitcoin safe. Also, next up, we have CoinTracker to the podcast. And listen, someone messaged me about this. They put something on Reddit and say, hey, why are you supporting tax? Taxes of the government. Look, listen, I'm not supporting tax, but some people pay their tax because, you know what? They don't want to get fucking arrested. I pay my tax. Doesn't mean I support it. And to be honest, crypto taxes are a real fucking pain to do. They take forever. The great thing about CoinTracker, it does it for you really easily. So listen, if you don't want to pay your tax, cool, you can skip this. That's down to you. But if you do pay your tax and you're fed up with the pain in the ass of doing your crypto taxes, then check out CoinTracker because it's the best. I used it for mine this year. The filings work for the US, UK, Canada, and Australia. And it's free for users who have 200 or fewer transactions in a year. Also, for listeners of the show, if you do want to use it, you can get a 10% discount by using the link cointracker.io/a/WBD. So if you are doing your taxes, if you're finding these crypto taxes a pain in the ass, definitely check out CoinTracker. It's at CoinTracker.io. And lastly, I do want to give a big shout out to Travel by Bit, who've sponsored my travel in South America. They are a travel website that allow you to book flights and hotels in Bitcoin. They also offer sats back on all your purchases up to 10%. I've traditionally used Momondo and Expedia. I always compare the two. Just give me the cheapest flight. That's all I'll take. But I've added Travel by Bit into the mix now, and they're competitive. And also, on some flights, they're cheaper. Not all of them, but on some flights, they are cheaper as well, which is really, really useful. So if you want to find out more, head over to travelbybit.com, which is TravelByBit.com. Okay, so we'll get into the challenges. An interesting point there is you mentioned multiple currencies. List me all the different currencies that are available here and how people use them in different scenarios. So, I mean, so I'll lead. I know, obviously, you have the Bolivar. You've become dollarized recently, although people were using dollars before. You have Bitcoin. You have the Petro. You know, you have the Colombian peso. You just mentioned the Brazilian. Yeah. So, are there any other currencies people are using?
Recently, I saw an article on Crypto Noticias that talks about 5 currencies here.
Okay.
We can talk about the peso, the real, and maybe some petro, because even when there are... So, some people said that there was 1 million transactions on the Petro, but the people that say that is the people of the government. So, I don't think that we can take that stat like, oh, yeah, they make that. But welcome. Also, the Petro, Bitcoin, and maybe other but in a tiny number of euros.
Euros, yeah. So what is the primary currency that people are using day to day right
now? Bolivar.
So it's still Bolivars, not the dollar.
We are still using Bolivars, but we use the dollar as the reference. So if we have a change on the exchange rate between Bolivar and dollar, obviously you will have to pay more Bolivars to afford your food. But people are trying to spend dollars directly because the merchant seems to want to keep the dollars. So they are making dollars payment easier and cheaper. So people start to spend normally dollars. And even I live in a popular zone, so even there I see people spending on dollars and no problem with that. But
how do you access dollars here?
I don't know how the dollar gets into Venezuela. I think that is the people that travel in here and the borderline,
like me coming here and spending it.
Yeah, and but not like tourists like come here, like more people like are visiting their family, and
they bring some in.
Yeah,
but if you wanted to get some dollars, how would you get it? Say if you wanted $100, how would you get that?
I have to go to WhatsApp,
okay.
Public, and I'm looking for some dollars. So the main problem with that is that I have to trust the people that I will buy the dollars. So that make the deal reduce it to a tiny and little trusty circle. So after the WhatsApp, if I can find an offer, so I go to ask so to some friends that have many contacts that have a, I don't know to call if I can call it to a network, but these people that used to know how to buy faster than me. So if I can, in these two cases, I have to contact another person that I trust and maybe he can find, but it's not so easy as you can find in local newspapers.
Okay.
So maybe that's why people start to look on these options in the first case, because you can avoid the trust process, you can avoid some process to just save some money.
So day to day then, the majority of the time you're using the Bolivar, are you carrying it around in cash or are you spending it digitally?
Always digitally. You only have Bolivars to pay for your transport,
okay,
for the gas.
My handler mentioned to me there's an app now that most people are using to spend it. What was that called?
Pago Móvil.
Is everybody using that?
Yeah, I only have one bank account.
Okay.
But I have a Pago Móvil of a friend that went off of the country. So when I have to spend Bolivars, I change some sats. I get the Bolivars. And if the exchange rate is buried in the bank account of my friend, I simply use this Pago Móvil to move the money to my own account, because I have a public bank. I get the account when I was in the college. So,
is the app a bit like Venmo?
I think so.
It's like Venmo.
Okay, so it's okay. So you can put money in and out of it from your bank account.
Yeah, you can transfer to any bank nationally without fees.
Okay, but the Bolivar, you still got quite high inflation here. I saw last year it was just around 10,000%. Is that still a problem for you, or is this something you're used to? How do you cope with the inflation?
Yes, I think we're used to inflation. Every week the inflation goes up 10%, something crazy. And yes.
Okay. So what is the use case for Bitcoin for you then? How are you using Bitcoin, and how are your friends using Bitcoin and other people you know? What are the primary use cases right here?
I said that I work as a journalist. I get my entire paycheck on Bitcoin.
Okay.
Since I think like 2 years, like I don't have any other income. Like I only earning sats, but I lost my keys, so I don't have any Bitcoin. But
you lost your keys?
Yeah.
Was it a boating accident?
Yeah, I traveled in a boat accident over. Yeah, but I don't think like others use Bitcoin as I use it, because I think like this is a privilege to can earn sats directly. A privilege here in Venezuela, as we understand that Bitcoin is volatile, but the Bolivar is worth, so I do prefer the Bitcoin payment. But I don't think like other people that are trying to exchange dollars to get Bolivars and are using Bitcoin to make this easier. I don't think like they're using Bitcoin as I do, so I can just stack. I can exchange the exactly amount that I think that I would need in Bitcoin to get Bolivars and spend like in 15 minutes. I know I will buy food, so I I do a trade. I go.
Is that on local bitcoins?
Yeah. Okay. Obviously, we have other options. We have Hodl Hodl that recently have. We have a meetup over Hodl Hodl to show people how to use it, but there's no enough liquidity, so we are paying the price of the KYC, but the liquidity is there, so we are using it.
Ah, the liquidity is on local Bitcoin. Okay, I understand. Okay, tell me also about the Petro.
Well, the Petro is the mother of all the shitcoins.
It's the
worst because what's pre-mined is centralized. It is issued by the authoritarian government. It has no public information. You can't run a node. You can see a block explorer, but you need private information on the transaction to see something. Like you can see how are the movements, and people are receiving $60 million over their phones on national TV like a joke. Like, yeah, I sent you the Petros, take that, to make public politics go. So it have all the red flags that we find on the cheat coins, but worse because as you see, we don't have a crypto nation. You have been here, so you can state that. But the government is trying to push this narrative that if we can make the Petro a common tool of payments, we will save everything. Everything will change. We will a crypto nation in the. We will the best country in the world because it is backed in oil. We are making an historical movement and blah,
but
blah,
it's not backed by oil, really. It's not like oil that's been extracted from the ground and being stored. It's the promise of oil in the ground.
There's one thing in that oil that is it's extra heavy.
Yeah, heavy oil is hard to hard to refine.
And those 2,400 million barrels, I don't know, are on the ground, and we don't have a strong industry that can have those outside, and then so it's not only a promise on that. It's like we magically will have that, and we will have the and it's also backed on different commodities like diamonds, gold. So they are trying to make to diversify the backing,
like a basket of a bit like Libra.
Yeah. But with oil and other precious things.
Okay. All right. I think that covers the main currencies people are using. In terms of Bitcoin, though, you've got unique challenges here for using it. So I know Caracas, the power here is generally okay. It most of the time stays on, right? But there are blackouts in the provinces, as I understand it. And if you've got a digital money, it's useless without power. Secondly, when I was in Cúcuta, there were two primary issues there that people were talking about. Firstly, people are sharing phones. They don't have a phone each, which is a problem for something like Bitcoin. And also, even if they have a phone, they don't necessarily have access to data. Are these the main issues, or are there other issues here that people aren't recognizing which would prevent Bitcoin being used widely?
I recently interviewed Andreas Antonopoulos, and he asked me that. Like, if you don't have electricity and don't have internet, how do you use Bitcoin? Well, I said exactly this. We can't use Bitcoin in that conditions. Like in Caracas, it's okay. We can have a meetup. We can come here to the Big Brothers pub and make a meetup, and we have internet and use Lightning and excellent. But outside Caracas, and the things get wilder, like in Zulia, in Bolivar, in Merida, in Los Angeles, in the region in general, in all the other places that is not Caracas, they are struggling daily blackouts in Barquisimeto. I have a friend that we have a podcast, and we have many troubles to record because he don't have lights many times. So how we can use Bitcoin if we can't even communicate with each others with WhatsApp?
Right.
So obviously we can face that, but the Big Brother had the first lightning torch in the mid of the blackout. So that's a kind of experience, but not all the users of Bitcoin have the mediums to make that heroic act to receive the torch in mid of the black.
Right, okay. So if people were looking into Venezuela and they wanted to help, you know, support Bitcoin here, what do you think the realistic use case is for Bitcoin here? Here in the east of the city where people are, you know, relatively in a comfortable position, but also in, I mean, is there any use for Bitcoin for people living in the poorer neighborhoods, in the slums, or is that just a ridiculous scenario?
As I say, I live in a slum, but I don't see it clear because you have to be trusted in that kind of community to make a connection with someone that have, I don't know,
soup kitchen, dining kitchen.
Yeah, like a soup kitchen, you have first to approach to the people and then, well, I have this Bitcoin thing, like I can help you to make some donation. Maybe it's difficult to make this convo more common with people that are working in that places, or even with the people that live there. They don't have any interest in Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies at all. But if you can find some places where those people are working on some humanitarian causes, maybe you can help.
But as a donation?
Like a donation.
But there's no day-to-day use case for poorer people here in Venezuela.
One of the most recent experience, and it came from 2016, is that people has been bartered and stuff. Not just, we have seen cases outside Caracas, especially, where you cannot use the Bolivar because it's worth nothing. You have no access to dollars, so how are you going to manage to get food, for example? So we interview a farmer, for example, he grows plantains, bananas, and the other guy who grows tomatoes. So they came back to that era of humanity where they traded. I'll give you plantains, you give me tomatoes. And they went to a guy with some cows, and they traded a couple tomatoes and plantains for milk or for meat and that kind of stuff. Like in these places inside the country, in the countryside, maybe they can find a use for this kind of digital thing. The big challenge here is what he was saying. First of all, people to get to know how the platform works, which benefits will it bring. And the other one would be people to trust this, in the data, of course, the electricity. There's a big wall in front of Bitcoin users here in Venezuela.
So one of the big issues is education. Yeah. So I know with you guys, Bitcoin is a store of value. You hold value, and essentially it's a savings tool, but it's a way of kind of countering the effects of hyperinflation. So as you hold Bitcoin, as you need bolivars, you transfer out, and that stops you avoiding the 10%, you know, weekly inflation, right? So I get that. That's very interesting. But that's obviously a use case for anyone in this country. Is there a culture of saving here? You know, is this something that could be taught to everyone? You know, because I hear it and I think, oh yeah, sounds like that's a great use case. But then I hear the average salary is $6 a month. You know, I expect most people are spending every cent they have. Trying to teach about savings is almost condescending. Do you know condescending? Patronizing? Yeah. I always think it's condescending. It's just not a reality. What do you think about that?
Well, we don't have a saving culture here. We was the country with the most consumption of BlackBerry phones. So like we want everyone had a BlackBerry. And we are used to spend money traveling around the world. Like we had a thing like was called Kadivi, like gave you some dollars so you can spend like wherever you want. But in this new scenario where you need to save money, people don't really have a low time preference. That's not a thing like you can have here because you are forced to daily fight with the depreciation of your money if you are earning bolivars, or with fighting with the depreciation of your dollars, because even dollars are getting inflated here because of all the issues that the production structure have, or the merchant structure in general. So it's difficult even when we have these meetups that we try to educate the people around Bitcoin, and we talk about it like a long-term alternative. See, like you can buy, I don't know, $100 and hold it for 6 months. Maybe you will have more money in terms of dollars. Obviously in bolivars you will have more, but
yeah, of course
you can have, I think like you can have a little more money in some kind of view because you're only holding there your fat. So maybe is that a way that we can make this saving technology sexier, but it's not an idea that the people is used to. Like we don't have this saving culture at all.
No. I also hear, I'm going to go back to altcoins, shitcoins. The two that I've heard a lot about here is Dash and Bitcoin Cash. Dash has done a lot of work to say, you know, there's high usage of Dash here. There's, you know, plenty of adoption. And Bitcoin Cash, I think they put out something saying there's more retailers accepting Bitcoin Cash than Bitcoin here. Again, what is the reality of that? Is that true? Are people using it? Why are they using it? Are they being incentivized? Is this a natural growth? What's the deal here?
Here in Caracas, we have a mall that is called City Market. That is a place where you can find many places where you can spend Bitcoin Cash. And there are other places where you can find that they accept Bitcoin Cash. But I personally asked so to many of those, and they are thinking that they are accepting Bitcoin, BTC.
Oh, they're confused.
So they don't really know that they are accepting Bcash. So this is the kind of misinformation that Bitcoin.com is doing over the people that is trying to diversify the payment option. So okay, it's a kind of pain because they are thinking that they will get sats, but they are accepting Bcash. They don't know. And there's Dash. So I personally have, I don't think like all the people that work with Dash are bad. I personally knew some people that I think that are working because they they think that it could be useful to others, and don't really know in deep the Dash trade-off, like the DAO is a centralized movement, and so how is that a cryptocurrency decentralized, etc. And they have built a community here. So, yeah, you can say that Dash is a thing here. Yeah.
Okay.
But not so big like the numbers of the DAO say, like plus 55,000 wallets of Dash here. I don't know where are those users. I don't know if they are faking the numbers. I don't saying that, but I don't see those people here now.
Have you spoken to the retailers, and have you any idea of the volume of transactions that are happening?
Well, in Tracky, that is a big big store, big retailer store. They have less than 1% of the sales on crypto in general, even Bitcoin. Bitcoin is the more used, but it's really little the percent. Also, there are other payment processors, because in Tracky you have PundiX that have a POS there. Mm-hmm. You have Crypto Buyer processor that is a software where you can pay. And you have other people that also have Crypto Buyer, other people that have XPay that is other payment processor, but only have the option to receive the payment, don't make that the people will spend money there. We are spending money to test how that works. In my personal experience, is don't spend sats.
Yeah.
You should change bolivars and spend bolivars on specs here directly, because these processors, even when they are trying to make something useful, they will charge you a fee, they will change the rates, so you will spend more money.
And it takes forever. I've also gone to Tracky, this store, to pay with sats, and usually you have to wait for a half an hour because there's 10 cashiers, but they say like, oh, wait, we need to get the manager because we don't know how it works. We need to get the manager to come here to actually see you making the payment and make sure everything's fine. So something that could take with bolivars, it would take you 10, 15 minutes. If you want to pay with Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies, it will take you half an hour, 40 right. minutes.
And back in the day when Dash was a real big thing here, like there was making meetups, they was giving away Dash, etc. Back in the day, you went to the merchant and asked, yeah, I want to pay with Dash. And they say, well, the owner of the place is not here, we can accept the Dash. And this is a thing that I...
Because they didn't want it.
They not just don't want it, don't know how to receive the payment. The people that make the agreement with the Dash representative is not here, so I can't receive this.
So people just need to stop thinking as crypto as a solution to buying things in Venezuela.
Yes. Maybe if we can find a way to make Dogecoin very useful, so you can spend very, very cheap. But if not, if it is not simple, if you can use it in a really easy way, people don't want to adopt it. And it's normal. We don't have the time to learn about Bitcoin, about other crypto. I have the time because I work as this. This is my job. I have to report on Bitcoin, and I have this privilege, but not many people have the time to, oh yeah, I will learn about Bitcoin, I will run node.
Okay. So to close out, What's the message to everyone who keeps focusing on Venezuela, keeps looking at Venezuela and go, there is your Bitcoin use case, Venezuela, look at Venezuela, we can help the people of Venezuela. It's like, what's your kind of closing statement with regard to that?
Well, we are a few Bitcoiners here, but we understand like the importance of censorship resistance, like we understand the importance of decentralization. We are a few people working on educational stuff, like helping others to understand how this works. There are projects working here, so there are people working here, but this is not a very massive thing, so you can help many people here trying to help them with money. Okay. So, like, help them to get donations of Bitcoin, like with the humanitarian project of Bitcoin Venezuela. Maybe it's a good way to help people to get the spotlight, to get more donations, but I don't know.
Okay. All right. Well, listen, look, it's been amazing to come here and see it. I think it's an amazing city, an amazing country. I really like the people. I want to come back. Hopefully I'll be able to come back. And, you know, a big love to you guys for your hospitality. It's been really good. If people want to get hold of you, if they want to talk to you about what's happening here in Venezuela, how do they reach out to you?
You can find me on Twitter at Crypto Bastardo.
With an I, not a Y.
Okay.
Crypto, C-R-I-P-T-O. So crypto, is that how crypto is spelled with an I here?
Yeah.
Yeah, in US, UK, it's with a Y.
No, with an I.
Yeah.
You can find me as Crypto Bastardo. I'm also in Satoshi in Venezuela. That is an educational project we are organizing here.
Okay.
And also you can find the Big Brothers
VC. Yeah, I'll get it. I'll put it in the show notes. All right. Listen, appreciate your time, guys. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you very much. I'm too happy.
Okay, so what did you make of that? Did you enjoy that interview with Javier? Did you enjoy finding out more about Venezuela? Getting out there was a real eye-opener for me. I've always wanted to go, actually. I don't know why. Venezuela's always been one of those countries I wanted to visit. But, you know, probably without all this crazy Bitcoin stuff going on and gotten to know Alejandro Machado, I probably wouldn't have gone. But he kind of sold me on the idea to go out there and check it out. He did give me lots of warnings, but I'm glad. I'm glad I went because, you know, I've been guilty of seeing Venezuela as this great use case for Bitcoin. And, you know, while there are use cases, they are niche and they tend to be the reserve of the educated and financially stable. Well, you know, financially stable relative to Venezuela. But there are a lot of poor people. There's a lot of poverty and, you know, Bitcoin isn't really for them. You know, people can use Bitcoin to earn money, whether it's mining or trading, and there is some limited use for remittance, but Bitcoin won't be fixing Venezuela. The needs there run a lot deeper. When a huge portion of the Venezuelan people just want to feed themselves and their family, and they share phones and have limited or no access to data, you really can see some of the challenges for Bitcoin there. Or, you know, it's even just... it's just the wrong thing to be thinking of it as a solution for some of these problems. I saw some really, really fucking desperate situations. One that really stuck with me was when I was in Cucuta on the border between Venezuela and Colombia. I was at an NGO to do an interview, and this guy, the Spanish lad, grabbed me and he just asked if he could be interviewed. He really wanted to be. He'd been living on the street. He'd been sleeping on the street for a week with his wife and his baby, and they hadn't barely eaten. They were relying on handouts from the NGO, and, you know, he was telling me how desperate it was and was crying, and, you know, it was fucking awful. It was a really shit thing to see. So I don't know, it just feels wrong to be trying to focus too much on Bitcoin. I just want to focus on the actual problems there and understand that a bit more myself. Sorry, I'm rambling now. I don't want to just paint a negative picture, though. The people were amazing. I had such a good time as well. They were so friendly, all smiles, all welcoming. I loved it. I really loved it, and I really want to go back. I'd love to go back at a time when, you know, they've got a better situation, you know, democracy and not this fucking mafia state bullshit that they're suffering under Maduro. But yeah, I loved it. Really, really did love it. I do want to give a big shout out and thanks to a few people as well, though. Javier and Adam for their hospitality. Also my fixer. I can't name him because obviously he's secret, but my fixer looked after me and my producer for 2 days. Like, massive thanks. Every need was covered. Honestly, it was amazing. We did make a mini documentary. We've been filming loads of stuff. We're going to get that out soon. Look, it's my first one. Might be a bit ropey, but bear with it. Okay, yeah, I'm rambling. Anyway, listen, I hope you enjoyed this interview. As always, any feedback, hit me up on hello@whatbitcoindid.com. If you want to support the show, get on my website. It's www.whatbitcoindid.com. Click on the support section. And yeah, any questions, hit me up. I'm about to get on a flight to El Salvador. Hope to hear from you soon. And yeah, have a great weekend.